This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, a conversation about Connecticut's juvenile justice system. We'll also take a closer look at Governor Dan Malloy's recent proposal for a second chance society. But first, author and journalist Nell Bernstein. In her latest book, Burning Down the House, she explores the dark side of the nation's juvenile prison system. Through the eye-opening stories of incarcerated youths, she argues that it's time to shut down the nation's juvenile prisons. Nell recently joined me at the Mark Twain House in Hartford to share some of those stories and to talk about the need for juvenile justice reform in America. We spoke in front of an audience, and here's a bit of our conversation. Talk about how the rates of juvenile incarceration here in the United States compare with the rest of the world, because we really are an outlier.
They really don't compare. Some countries just don't lock up kids at all. I think our closest competitors, places like Somalia, lock up kids at about a tenth of the rate that we do. So it is a uniquely American approach to adolescence. And it's tricky because on the one hand, we're in a tremendous moment of change. The number of kids incarcerated as juveniles has dropped 40% over the course of about a decade. And my understanding is that that's almost double here in the state of Connecticut, which is phenomenal. At the same time, that drop only brings us back to the rate that existed in the 1980s prior to the introduction of a mythical creature called the super predator, which led to a huge escalation in the number of kids who are locked up. So it's sort of a half full, half empty, literally, situation right now.
Why is it that we've done better? I mean, what have we learned in these last few years or decades that we didn't know before?
Those are two different questions, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
On the one hand, we have learned a lot about, for example, adolescent brain development. We've learned that the brain keeps developing until 25, and that has informed particularly the debate around incarcerating juveniles as adults. We've learned that incarceration doesn't work. Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow, wrote a tremendous op-ed a couple years ago talking about the difference between a shift driven by financial concerns and one driven by a moral imperative. And she made the case that it matters which kind of a change we're seeing. And honestly, we've known this forever, but it costs $80,000 to lock a kid up for a year, as opposed to about $10,000 to educate that child. In California, where I live, it got as high as $225,000 a year. So honestly, there's been tremendous advocacy, tremendous advances in the research, but I do think it was the Great Recession that freed the children, and that still leaves us with some profound problems in how we see and treat our kids.
One of the things that did happen here and has happened elsewhere in the country is this idea that we would raise the age and not prosecute 16 and 17-year-olds, for instance, as adults. That's something that Connecticut has changed some years ago, and which we see as a good thing. But in part, I guess I'm wondering if it allows us to skip over a part of the problem. We think, well, adult jail is the bad jail, and we don't want 17-year-olds in the bad jail, because juvenile jail must be something much better. It must be something much more rehabilitative. Tell us a bit about that.
It is fantastic that Connecticut made that shift. Folks probably know Connecticut was an outlier in treating 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. I think New York still does it, maybe one other state. Automatically, you can still here, as in across the country, choose to prosecute a child as an adult, and we can talk about that. But, you know, I think what you're taking me to is something that seems like semantics but isn't. There's actually no such thing as a juvenile prison, technically. I use that word very deliberately instead of talking about training schools, academies, boys' ranches, camps, the multiple euphemisms that we use to describe, and I'm talking really about the large state facilities where we incarcerate kids. I call them juvenile prisons because when I visit them, you know, the first thing I see is the double coil of razor wire. There's a guard station that I have to drive past. There's sally ports. There's clanging metal doors. There's kids in shackles. There's kids walking military style with their hands behind their back or doing something called the chicken walk with their hands underneath their armpits, ostensibly for safety, but it creates a very humiliating and kind of militaristic atmosphere. And then there are cells. And I got a lot of flack as I visited some of these places for using words like cells. I was told, that's not a cell, that's a room. We don't keep kids in cells. And I said, well, can I look at one of these rooms? It's 8.5 by 11. It has a metal toilet. It has a concrete bunk, a 3-inch mattress. It's a cell. So the sad truth is that, you know, while it's profoundly important for a state like Connecticut not automatically to incarcerate juveniles in adult prisons, the difference is not as significant, I think, as we would like to believe.
What is the reason for keeping kids in these cells in the way that they do? When you ask people who are administrators at these facilities about the conditions, what do they say? What's the reason behind the conditions?
You know, it's a very circular kind of reasoning. The folks who work inside these places are not the bad guys. In many cases, obviously there are some gruesome exceptions to that when you look at the abuse that takes place, but people who've been working inside one of these places for 20 or 30 years know the kids much better, for example, than the general public does, understand what they're going through, and very often understand that it's not a useful place for a kid to be. That said, at the administrative level, when I ask that question, the answer is safety and security. Now, here's the problem with that. You know, I believe that there's no government without the consent of the governed. And I think for folks who are parents or who have had parents, we know that our authority doesn't lie in our ability to lock our kids in their rooms. If we put them in the equivalent of solitary confinement, CPS would be knocking at our door. It's our relationships with our kids that ground the authority that we have over them. So inside a locked facility, relationships are rationed, hostile, profoundly limited, and without any sense of connection between the kids and the people in charge of them, yeah, maybe then you do have to resort to physical force, but only when you don't give them what they need in order to grow up.
And you write about the fact that while there are so many people who do try to do the best job they can with the situations that they've been given to take care of these kids, there are many other gruesome individuals who compromise this idea of a relationship. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that, about the profound impact that guards, that correctional officers in these facilities have on the lives of young people who are so impressionable and so vulnerable, obviously because of their age, their size, their strength.
Yeah. When you talk about the abuses that take place inside these facilities, it's almost hard to know where to begin. You know, what I'm going to talk about now is not stories that I've been told by kids, although I have a lot of those, but things that have been documented mostly in federal investigations of these places. But you have, for example, stories of girls forced to run in 100-degree heat carrying logs. And when they collapse and vomit from heat exhaustion, are forced to eat their vomit. Kids who are hog-tied, stripped naked, and this is something I have experienced with kids I know, not experienced, but heard from, stripped naked and tossed into a bare solitary cell for expressing suicidal thoughts. One young woman who was very dear to me got in a fight. She was 18, so she was serving county time for juvenile warrants, but she got in a fight and was stripped naked and put in a cold cell. Do people know what cold cells are? It's a technique the CIA uses to extract information from terrorist suspects. It's a cold cell. It's a bare room with tiles and a drain, and you're stripped naked and kept there in freezing conditions until you break and confess your intent to blow up a subway. But this was a girl who had grown up in foster care, had been in 30 or 40 placements, and had run from some pretty dismal group homes in order to keep a job and save money for college. So she had outstanding warrants and was told that she couldn't get financial aid until she got rid of those by doing 3 or 4 days of county time, got in a fight, ended up in a cold cell. And
yeah, I was just saying, this is Eliza. This is the story of Eliza.
It's Eliza, right? Yeah. A girl who was really dear, just a brilliant girl with a brilliant future. And if it had been the CIA, I think they would have called it a success because they did break her. It turned out she requisitioned her CPS file and learned that as a baby, she'd been left alone for days in her crib when her mother would go out to score. And she said she regressed in the cold cell.
And it said she would cry when they threw her in. She would wail and cry, and she wouldn't stop wailing and crying. And that's what she learned about herself. I mean, what broke in her was this regression to this time in which she truly was a baby, and
it couldn't have been more effective if their intent had been to break her spirit. And even the CIA, if they use this technique, right, they have to get it signed off on by the number two. But in county jail, it just was sort of, here you go. But you asked me about what the relationship between the guards and the kids does.
Yes.
And I wonder, I wasn't going to do this, but could I read a passage?
I would love
because
for
there,
you to
there's
that,
a passage that I just, you know, the kids didn't just tell me sob stories. They knew what was being done to them, and they knew what they needed, and they knew what the effect of what was happening was. And in this case, this is a young man talking about how spiritually and morally corrosive it was for him to be behind bars for his own malfeasance, and yet to be treated in this really inhumane way. Darren was kneeling, but he was not praying. Baptized Catholic and brought up in the church, Darren had turned to his faith to get him through the early years of a decades-long confinement, including months spent on isolation units. Now he found himself forced to his knees, hands cuffed behind his back, stripped to his boxers, one in a long row of boys in the same supplicant pose. They would be required to hold this position for 2 full weeks, their only respite a daily 3-hour block allotted for sleep and a quick meal, a cheese sandwich, milk, and an egg. Darren had just been transferred from one facility to another when a large-scale fight broke out on his unit. No effort was made to distinguish bystanders from those who had joined in. Witness, participant, instigator, it made little difference to those doling out punishment, it seemed to Darren. Once individuality has been successfully eradicated, and this is key, I think, to the sort of degradation of incarceration, via uniforms, strict schedules, regulation of daily activity, restricted contact with the outside world, and prison-supplied numbers supplanting given names, punishing the many for the sins of the few comes to seem logical, if not essential, to the all-important aim of maintaining order. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. During Darren's weeks on his knees, the silence made the banter of the guards difficult to ignore. They talk and chat and giggle and joke, he recalled, a slight edge creeping into his otherwise even manner. And you just sit there. I was on my knees for 2 weeks. I lost my religion in there, Darren said. I just stopped believing. Prostrate before grown men, to whom he might as well have been invisible, listening to the guards laugh and joke as their charges knelt before them, visibly suffering, Darren silently sought answers. How can the people here do the things they do to children? He asked the heavens. No answer was forthcoming. So I guess that's a long way of saying, I can't answer your question. I found myself reading philosophical texts about the nature of evil to try to understand how this could happen, and I'm still struggling with it.
Evil is perhaps too big an issue to take on, even in a book like this. But to get more down to ground level, both of those stories that we just heard about, they start with a fight inside. And one of the things that I find so fascinating about this is there are things that kids can go to jail for that adults can't. I mean, I'm allowed to drink. I'm older than 21. But you can get handcuffed and arrested for drinking as a teen. And there's a lot of other things at your school you might. So first, there's this idea that you may go in for some reason that's not all that serious. And then one thing happens, one fight that you might not even be involved in, it just seems now like some of these stories, the kids are on such an edge where if they just have one terrible thing happen or one bad day, their whole lives are tipping over. And I think that's one of the really infuriating things about the stories that you tell in here.
And that's true for some kids, both on the outside, on the streets and in school, and then again once they're on the inside. But it's not true for my kids because they're white. And that, again, I have two 14-year-olds, and all the statistics about what we like to kind of distance ourselves by calling racial disparities are really coming to life for me. Because a term like racial disparities allows us to believe that there may be differences in delinquent or criminal activity among the races, and there are not. In fact, the starkest example is drug offenses, which white kids are significantly more likely to commit than black kids, but I don't have the number at my fingertips, but it's like 100 times less likely to be locked up for. You know, I thought there'd be a chapter about race in the book. I didn't think I could write a book about juvenile justice without a chapter about race. There's no chapter, because what I found was that it drives every aspect of this system. And when you combine those disparities with the fact that juvenile incarceration doubles the likelihood of adult incarceration, and one more stat, and then I'm just going to ease up on the stats. In confidential interviews, well over 90% of all Americans acknowledge having done something as teenagers that is not only illegal, but under the law could have got them locked up. And that may seem high, but just think back a little bit. And see, I bet everybody can come up with something. But not all of us were locked up for that thing. So that's a turning point, right? The kids who have the safety net because of race and class and where they live, and the kids who don't. And all this together, along with being a parent, has really driven home for me this notion that there's no such thing as a juvenile delinquent. We actually don't have, at the beginning, good kids and bad kids. It's a developmental phase. And the kids who get a pass of that 90%, those who are diverted or most often are privileged to experience what Glenn Martin calls the most successful diversion program in history, being white. They just grow up and grow out of it. There's no intervention needed. It's those kids who are sucked into the system and get into that fight and put in solitary who spiral.
You mentioned Michelle Alexander and the new Jim Crow, and she did a program with us here on these issues, and she talks very provocatively about institutional racism. I mean, is that what it is? Is it specifically institutional racism within these facilities, within our system of justice?
I think that lets the rest of us off the hook a little bit. Yeah, there's racism within the facilities, but
within the police departments, within society, but specifically in the criminal justice end of society, is I guess what I'm talking about, not just in the facilities itself.
Absolutely. You know, the most kind of profound way to see that is to go into a locked facility in a state like Oregon, which is mostly white, and see a bunch of white kids wearing the orange uniforms. And everyone I know who's had that experience has done a kind of double take, because you don't see that. There's no describing how profound it is. But I don't think we can pin it all on the system. I know we've had a series of incidents with police that have been rightly profoundly troubling. But we also have to deal with the fact that we live in segregated neighborhoods, some of which are policed and some of which are not, that some schools have on-site police officers channeling the kids who get into a fight into the system, and other schools have conflict resolution and peer mediation. So I think, you know, as you said, we can't solve the problem of evil tonight, and we also can't solve the much deeper racial problems that drive. You know, I think Michelle is right that over-incarceration drives a lot of the racial injustice in this country, but it's also true in the inverse.
That's Nell Bernstein talking about her latest book, Burning Down the House. When we come back, we'll listen to more of my conversation with Nell at the Mark Twain House in Hartford at an event about youth incarceration. It was co-sponsored by the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're listening to my interview with Nell Bernstein at the Mark Twain House in Hartford. It was co-sponsored by the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center. Nell's latest book is called Burning Down the House, which takes a critical look at the nation's juvenile prison system.
How much of the daily lives of the children that you profile really are taken up by something that we'll call punishment? And how much of their daily lives are taken up by something that we might want to call rehabilitation?
Do you mean once they're in the system or before?
Once they're in the system, once they're behind bars in a cell or a room, a school or a prison, whatever you want to call it, what's the balance between rehabilitation and punishment?
So I don't mean to keep ducking the question, but I don't think you can make that distinction, because even with the best intentions and the most evidence-based programs, I don't think you can be rehabilitated inside a cell. There's a movement right now, along with the movement to reduce the number of kids behind bars, to turn juvenile prisons into therapeutic communities. And it's very well intentioned. And I went into some of these places with very high hopes. You know, so the kids will be in group a lot of the day. They're using state-of-the-art models that were developed outside of prison facilities. But at the end of the day, when the person running group, to whom you're supposed to confess some pretty profound traumas, either literally or theoretically holds the key to your cell, I think that that undermines the whole enterprise. I mean, when you or I talk to a therapist, at minimum we expect confidentiality, and we certainly don't expect legal consequences for what we talk about. But I visited, for example, a sex offenders unit in California that had been turned into, I was told, an intensely therapeutic model. And these kids were telling me, you know, if I don't open up enough in group, or if what I say doesn't match what's in my file, I get dinged and I can get a time ad when time comes for me to go to the parole board for not participating with the program. Same thing for psychotropic medications. Darren, the same young man, spent months in solitary for refusing to take psychotropic medications for therapeutic purposes, because he had never been diagnosed with anything outside of this facility, and his mother didn't even let him take Advil. So it varies from zero to, I've been told, 12, 16 hours a day, and the places that try to be therapeutic are better. But it's, you know, really spitting into the wind, I think.
Do I have this right? And we have been heavy on the statistics. 1 in 10 kids in facilities like this have been sexually assaulted by guards? Not necessarily by other wards, but by guards.
Yeah, I mean, you have that right in that that's the official statistic, but, you know, it often doesn't go reported, so I think it's probably much higher. And that, I think also, I mean, talk about undermining your faith in a system or your effort to atone for your own misdeeds. I think it's 12% of kids are sexually assaulted behind bars, and we know that.
I spoke with our governor about some of his initiatives, and he rolled out a plan which he's calling a second chance society. It's meant to divert people from entering the justice system in the first place on one end, and easing their reentry after jail, really aimed at adult offenders. But I'm wondering what you've learned about the juvenile justice system that might inform our state's conversation about second chances, about this idea of taking some time in which you are in the system, but then coming out and being perhaps a different person and having a chance to have a better life.
That would be a wonderful thing. Kids come out and, you know, initially in the first few weeks are very motivated. Like my friend Eliza, who as soon as she turned 18 wanted to go to college. But like Eliza, they face so many barriers. It's very difficult to get re-enrolled in school. Sometimes schools won't take you back. Sometimes your records have been lost. If you've been on psychotropics, you very often go cold turkey, which can be physically challenging and can lead kids to self-medicate. Getting a job is tremendously difficult. There's a Ban the Box initiative that's trying to get the have you ever been arrested or convicted box off of at least government applications. So, you know, every door is slammed in their face. But, you know, what I would also say is the kids who don't get a second chance are the same kids who didn't get a first chance. They go back to the same heavily policed schools, the same, what sociologist named Victor Rios calls culture of control. The same issues with poverty and substance abuse. I kind of think if we gave them a first chance, we wouldn't need to put so much emphasis on giving them a second chance. I'll stop there, but that speaks to a concept called justice reinvestment, which if somebody asks me a question, I'm glad to talk more about.
I'll ask you, justice reinvestment. Look, but we talk about this here. We talk about the amount of money that we could spend on early childhood education and how that amount of money just increases and increases and increases. And this is how much money we spend on keeping someone in jail for a year. But if we spend just a little bit on the front end, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, in a very specific way. I mean, until this recent downturn, and on the adult side, which you asked about still, I sometimes talk about incarceration as the last standing entitlement. You know, as everything else was cut, it was this sort of untouchable item on the budget. That's changing. But what's not happening is justice reinvestment. So California, where I'm from, had 10,000 kids in our state facility. Now we have a few hundred. I understand that a similar trend has taken place in Connecticut. But where's the money going? In Massachusetts in the 70s, a guy named Jerome Miller was in charge of the system for a while, and he shut it down 100% and tried to find responses for the kids in the community. And it was very successful, but what he says is the true test of justice is when every dollar otherwise spent to lock a kid up follows that kid into his or her community. So we're taking some of the money, putting it into the general fund, hoping some of it goes in the right direction, but I think it needs to go to the neighborhoods that have been decimated by mass incarceration for decades and decades before we're going to really see kids getting that first chance.
Journalist and author Nell Bernstein talking about her latest book, Burning Down the House. She spoke with me on stage at the Mark Twain House in Hartford. When we return from our break, we'll hear from an advocate and a lawmaker about Connecticut's juvenile justice system and how it could be reformed. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We've been listening to author Nell Bernstein talking about what she sees as a coming end to juvenile prison. Her book is called Burning Down the House, and I spoke with her on stage at the Mark Twain House and Museum. It was an event co-sponsored by the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center and also by the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. But first, I want to welcome in Abby Anderson, who is Executive Director of the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. She joins me in studio. And Abby, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
Before we get into some of the specific legislation and ways in which you're hoping to influence the minds of lawmakers and other Connecticut citizens this time, you got a chance to hear a little bit of the conversation we had with Nell Bernstein. You were there that night as well. I guess I'm wondering maybe some of your takeaways as she talks about the experiences she had being inside juvenile prisons. And again, she calls them prisons, not detention centers or group homes or houses or schools or anything that we may euphemistically call them. She sees an America that may someday soon get rid of prison for juvenile offenders. Do you think that's a realistic idea?
I think it is a realistic idea when you look at all of the progress that's been made nationally and in Connecticut. Are we going to get to a day where we have zero prisoners? Maybe not in the near future, but I think we can get to a day when we have very, very few. When you look at what works, when you look at the goal of a criminal justice system, you know, we really take a look. If your goal is retribution, that's one thing. But if your goal is to hold somebody accountable for what they've done wrong in a way that has that accountability factor, but also make sure that your goal of community safety is met, what you really need to do is provide the kind of services that that person needs to make better decisions in the future. And sometimes we talk about that as decision making, but some of it is opportunities as well. So we have to make sure that people have the ability to take advantage of opportunities that are given to them. And when you look at different services like substance abuse services, mental health services, especially for young people, when you look at so many of the young people in the juvenile justice system, they started as victims. They started as people who came from having, you know, reading levels that are 4, 5, 6, 7 levels below where they were, where their peers are. So there's a lot of opportunity out there to do the kinds of programs and services that around the country have started to be used for young people who are offenders and even some serious offenders are in the community, are safe, are keeping the community safe, but are also having much better recidivism outcomes than putting people in prison.
What can you tell us about the young people who are serving time in juvenile detention in Connecticut today?
To get policy wonky on you, John, juvenile detention is actually a separate thing from prison. So detention is pretrial. What Nell was talking about is kids mainly who would be in what, you know, she called our euphemism, the Connecticut Juvenile Training School. The latest number I heard is somewhere between 80 and 90 kids who are
there. So it's less than 100 kids right now.
Absolutely, which is why we think we can, you know, we can get way lower than that. We built it, you know, this was part of the Governor Rowland scandal. It was built in 2000 for 240 kids. We've never had that many kids there. It's never been needed. But when you look at a lot of the kids there, some of them are there for more serious offenses, but a lot of the kids are there for repeat offenses of things that are really annoying that you don't want kids to be doing. So, you know, assault in the third, which is continually getting into a fight, or violation of probation, which a lot of times is going to be continuing to come up with dirty urines. And again, nobody's saying that these are behaviors that we want kids to do or that there should be no consequences for. But if we're having a hard time, if a kid is having a hard time getting off of drugs or dealing with their anger, putting them in a room is not really going to be the answer. And how do we deal with those behaviors and help them to change those behaviors?
Nell gets at this in her book for more of a national level, but what numbers do you have on how much it costs Connecticut to keep the 80 or 90 kids or so that are in a facility like this per year?
So DCF's estimate for the fiscal year that we're in right now, 2015, is $744 a day at CJTS. So, you know, you're looking at around, asking me to do math in my head in the morning, that's a lot, is what it is.
It's a lot of money. So that's $744 per kid.
Per day
for the entire year. Right. I want to bring in Themis Clardys, who's the Republican House Minority Leader. And we've spoken on the program about some of these issues in the past. But when you were on most recently, Themis, we didn't get a chance to spend very much time with this. And I'm glad that you're able to come in and talk more about this with us. Thanks, and welcome back to Where We Live.
Thanks, John. It's always great to be here.
I'm wondering if you can maybe talk a little bit before we get into some of the specific policy ideas that are happening at the Capitol right now. If you can talk about this idea about whether or not we really should be a society that locks up kids and puts them in, whether or not you call it a prison or a juvenile training school, and puts them away and treats them like adults in this way. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, certainly there are very strong trains of thought in different areas in regards to this. And I am certainly not an expert in this as my fellow guest is today. But, you know, I think it's a very delicate balancing act between saying there are kids that are doing bad things. Now, I know that she had mentioned things that are annoying, like getting into fights and dirty drug tests. But I think you have to look at it in the totality of the circumstances, based on what the other crimes they've committed are, based on who they have in their lives. Is there any family? Are there people that they're working with? Are they doing their best to get there? And I think that those are things that we really have to look at. So whether it is a juvenile or other issues we've been talking about with adults, I don't think it's as black and white as people make it out to be. Now, having said that, I think that with juveniles, there are certainly and clearly other issues that we have to look at in regards to whether they should be incarcerated or not, or at what level they should be incarcerated. But no question about it, programs that help them solve their problems so hopefully they can move forward and be productive adults in society, something we need to focus on.
Are the programs in place, Abby, to divert these kids elsewhere? If indeed juvenile prison isn't the place for them and $744 a day per child isn't the right number to pay, what do we have instead for them right now? And how much money would we save if we just get down to brass tacks about it, if we move them someplace else?
Well, there are certainly programs that exist, and Connecticut has done a great job. I mean, if you look 10 years ago, we were sending maybe 800 kids a year into committed delinquent status, whereas now we're down to maybe 250, 220. So we've done a great job of providing some alternative services, and these are things that, as the representative said, focus on the totality of the child's life. So looking at educational issues, looking at mental health issues, looking at family systems issues. So we talk in the field about the alphabet soup of programs, so these multi-systemic therapies or multi-dimensional family therapy, these ways that are much less expensive, so might be more like $10,000 or $12,000 for 6 months, versus when you're looking at, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars for a couple months for the juvenile training school. And there are a whole host of programs that are being looked at nationally that are the same sort of a thing. Unfortunately, when you look at incarceration, you are putting any peg into that cell hole, right? And as we know, everybody is an individual and everybody has a different mix of things that are going in, so risk and need factors. So there is a big movement nationally to look at kids as individuals and say, okay, what does this kid, what does this family need in order for this kid to be successful? And how do we wrap those services around? And some of those things are happening in jurisdictions around the country and being much more successful. So it's not rocket science, but it's looking at things like, you know, if you have a kid who has anger issues, it's getting them anger therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, looking at substance abuse issues. But also a lot of kids that are using substances are using for a reason. They are self-medicating. Mm-hmm. There's massive amounts of trauma among both boys and girls. So it's looking at, instead of why are you doing this, it's like, what's happened to you that got you here? Again, holding them accountable for the decisions that they've made, but looking at what's been going on behind that, too.
We're talking with Abby Anderson, who's executive director of the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance, and Themis Clarides, who's the Republican House Minority Leader. If you'd like to join our conversation about juvenile incarceration in our state, comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. And we did get a tweet from Anastasia before we had to break. With annual cuts to DCF, CSSD, and community and residential programs, where are kids who need out-of-home treatment going to be placed? Representative Clarides, this is one of the big issues. We in our state have seemingly, according to Ben Barnes, the OPM secretary, a state of permanent fiscal crisis. And in a state of permanent fiscal crisis, it seems as though the money necessary for the very types of programs that Abby Anderson is talking about that might keep kids from having to go into juvenile training schools or might divert them in some ways in their lives, educate them better, et cetera, the dollars for those things are going away. As a lawmaker, somebody who's looking quite clearly at this budget deficit and how to fill these holes, what do you say to that? How do we address the fact that we maybe have things that we know we should be doing, but might not have money to do?
Well, John, I think the very simple answer to that is priorities. Okay, we need to focus in this state on priorities. I think we all know what they are generally. I think certainly mental health programs, focusing on juveniles, as we've talked about today, and what they need to try and get them turned around so they can lead a productive lifestyle. It's priorities. It's what each and every one of us does in our homes. There are lots of things we want to spend money on, right? Lots of things. But there are things we know we have to spend money on. And so, you know, without getting political, spending millions of dollars on back nine or spending hundreds of million dollars on a busway that will never, ever, ever support itself, or spending money, hundreds of million dollars on a First Five program, moving businesses from one town to the next. Are those things we could look at? I mean, I don't think any of those were legitimate things to begin with. But let's just say you did. Let's just say you did for purposes of this. Those aren't the priorities when the other side is mental health programs, children's programs, helping people get off drugs so they can live productive lives. So it's about priorities. And I don't really know how else to say it. We get into this debate every year when we do a budget about, well, how could we possibly do this, this, and this? We have a deficit again. And it's tough. Listen, we don't get elected to this job for the glory. I'll tell you that. And in the past 6-8 years, it's been very difficult with all these deficits. But, you know, we sit here and we discuss these things, and these are things that are priorities, and lots of other things are too. And we have to learn to do that in state government.
I will say your statement was, you said not to make it political. It was slightly political, but I take your point. Would you and your caucus, would you pledge to lead these things as priorities, that indeed, if we can not spend money elsewhere and decide to spend it in other places, would you say, yeah, we should be spending more money on making sure that we have a better juvenile justice system, one that makes more sense for kids and has better outcomes?
Well, I would certainly prioritize it. And when we look back a few years ago to the tragedy that occurred in Newtown, and the subject of mental health came up, and fixing those kinds of problems and addressing people with those needs, you know, those are issues we need to look at. And I can't tell you what this budget is going to look like in the end of the day, because it'll certainly go through many versions before we vote on something. But I will tell you, you know, and I made the comment about not making it political. And I said that because when you make statements like that, you automatically become, oh, it was a Democrat governor or a Democrat legislature. And I have to tell you, there were things that our Republican governors did that we didn't agree with. So, like I said, it's about prioritizing no matter whose idea spending the money is. You can't spend it if there's other things that we all agree are more important.
We're talking with Emmis Claridis, who's the Republican House Minority Leader. Abby Anderson is here from the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. When we come back from a break, we're going to be talking about second look legislation, something that didn't pass the legislature during the last legislative session. Will it this time around? And we're also going to be talking about moving some of the services into the Department of Children and Families. Agency that has long been troubled. Some people are questioning that idea. Some people think that it's a very good way to deal with juvenile justice issues in the state. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Americans have been tipping for good service since the days of George Washington. Yet many of us still don't understand exactly when we should tip, how much we should leave, and the rules keep changing as more workers expect to be tipped at higher percentages. Is it finally time to give service workers a higher minimum wage and get rid of the whole idea of tipping? That's our conversation on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today we're talking about juvenile justice. Earlier in the program, we heard a conversation with Nell Bernstein, whose book is Burning Down the House. I had a conversation with her on stage at the Mark Twain House and Museum. It was co-sponsored by the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance and also the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center. I'm welcoming into the studio Abby Anderson, who is Executive Director of the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance, and also Themis Claridis, who's the Republican House Minority Leader. And we're going to be talking about second look legislation. Abby, this is something that it relates to what we're talking about, but it actually is slightly broader in its scope. Essentially, the U.S. Supreme Court has given guidance to the states that they need to align with federal law when it comes to the ability for state parole boards to look again at sentences that are very long sentences for people who are serving time for crimes that they committed as juveniles. Essentially, what this would do is not open up prison doors and let people out after 30 years, but it would give a chance to take a look at sentences. Again, these are for crimes committed as juveniles. Last time around, last legislative session, we thought this was going to pass because, again, there is a federal mandate for this, but indeed it did not make it through. Do you have any hope that it will this time? And maybe you can talk a little bit more about the legislative procedures on this from your end before I go to the representative.
We are pretty hopeful this year. And I just to be clear for folks, this is for people who were committed crimes as juveniles but are tried as adults. And they're in the adult, so they're in adult prison on the adult side. And as you said, it doesn't open the prison door for anyone. Basically, all it does is allow for a meaningful opportunity to have a parole hearing. So in the past, there had been, you know, sort of wrangling back and forth on different issues. Actually, very, very hopeful this year. This is a proposal that came out of the Nonpartisan Sentencing Commission. And at the public hearing this year, Senator Kissel, Senator Fasano, both, I think Senator Kissel said, you know, the third time's the charm. This is the third time the bill has been up. And there seems to have been negotiations and conversations where everybody's on the same page this year, and I think we can move forward in a positive way. But it's really important. Connecticut has done a really good job of reducing the number of young people under the age of 18 who are transferred to the adult court, and this is just another level of making sure that when we look at parole decisions or the possibility of parole decisions, that the age at offense is one of the factors that is looked at the parole issue.
Themis Claridis, when you were on with House Speaker Brendan Sharkey a couple of months ago, we talked about this, but it was very briefly at the end of our conversation. I didn't give you a whole lot of time to clarify your position. I'm wondering if you would support legislation like this, the legislation that you've seen this time around, and do you think that it's hopeful that it will pass?
Well, I believe that legislation we're talking about had already passed the House, and it was the Senate that was the issue. So I think we've done a lot of good work with it in the past few years. And that was, you know, as Abby refers to the senators, because they were the issue, and that's where the work needed to be done this year. But, you know, I certainly agree that age should be one of the criteria we look at, but it shouldn't be the only one. And I think that that's where people separate their opinion. There are people that believe that just because you're a minor, and, you know, and that means 16 or 17, that you, by definition, be tried as an adult if you've done that kind of crime. And I understand that we're dealing with different emotional levels of maturity, different mental levels of maturity, and lots of issues involved. But we have to remember that it is one of the factors we take in, but not the only factor.
Maybe you can just clarify that a little bit more. I mean, what would be the other factors that would be very important to you on this?
As we've discussed already today, family unit support, whether it's family or friends, educational support what school they're in, if they're in school, what their level of behavior is at school, mental issues, drug issues. I mean, there's certainly a whole host of factors that come into play.
I want to go to a quick phone call here. Larry is calling from Middlefield. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
When I was a kid, okay, back in the 60s, and I had a juvenile record, okay, nothing to be proud of, but things happened. The punishments were much different. Car theft or some petty theft like that would be 3-4 months probation, you know, and normally at the school or something along that line. They weren't talking about sending kids to jail. I think it was much more reasonable in that, okay, this is your first time, your first offense. You get a slap on the wrist, but it's firm and they watch you, you know, and you go through some. The probation officers also were like counselors.
Hey, Larry, I have to ask you, and thank you for raising this before I let you go. Did your experience as a juvenile offender in the past, what impact did that have on the rest of your life?
It really didn't affect me. In other words, I learned that I had a one-time thing, okay? And then I wound up going into service. I wound up serving with the State Department. I worked at embassies around the world, things along that line. So it was a learning experience, but it wasn't devastating. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Larry, thank you very much for that. Do you Abby, take Larry's point. I mean, do you think that the punishments that we levy on 16- and 17-year-olds for the types of crimes that he was talking about are different today than they were in the day?
It's hard to know. I do want to clarify, Connecticut and the judicial branch, the SSD, DCF, we have done over the past decade or so a really fantastic job of building out the diversionary and front-end system. So like I said, we're sending far fewer kids to prison. We're also sending far fewer kids to pretrial detention. So there are juvenile review boards, a lot of them, some of them funded by DCF, some of them funded by youth service bureaus, that are, you know, if you get arrested for a misdemeanor, you can go. They look at the family. They look at, it's called balanced and restorative justice in a lot of places. Oversimplifying, but it might be something as, you know, you graffiti the side of a storekeeper. The storekeeper comes in, explains, hey, this is why this was negative to me. This is the impact it had. And maybe as a punishment, you have to do an apology. You have to go clean the graffiti off. You know, really making those connections of what's going on. And most of the JRBs will also do, you know, assessments. Do you need mental health? Do you need educational supports? So we are doing a lot of work, as he said, working with probation officers, which are serving more like counselors and doing motivational interviewing and those kinds of things. So I think a lot of that actually moves forward. And what a great example Larry is of kind of normal adolescent behavior, got issues, and move forward.
Ms. Claritas, I have to ask you before we run low on time. Governor Malloy's budget that he released includes plans to strip Connecticut's judicial branch of its juvenile justice programs and hand over that authority to the Department of Children and Families. What do you think of this move?
I don't agree with that in any way, shape, or form, and here's why. We have seen and heard day after day, year after year, of the challenges that the Department of Children and Family Services has. Now, I'm not saying it's anybody's fault in particular, but that is a tough job. I'm dealing with a constituent right now that's in the middle of a situation like that. And I have to tell you, I would not support giving DCF any more responsibilities because they certainly have their hands full with the ones they have.
Abby, do you have any thoughts on this?
We testified as well that we don't support this piece. I think when you look at the juvenile justice system, the courts actually have 97%. And DCF runs 3% of the juvenile justice system. So to swap that, DCF, just structurally, it doesn't make sense. All of the work that has been done to reduce the number of kids in detention, the number of kids at CJTS, the expertise for that, as I said, it's 97% with CSSD. Another issue is if you talk to providers or other people, CSSD is almost obsessed with data collection and looking at those kinds of things. And data and looking at performance measures is one of the things that DCF, while working really hard at, has struggled with in the past. So we would have concerns just that I just don't think DCF has the expertise or is ready to do that. And if it's not broke, why fix it?
Themis Claritas, the broader question of Governor Malloy's Second Chance Society, which extends beyond juveniles, certainly to adults. There's a number of things on his plate, the repeal of mandatory minimums for drug offenders. I'm wondering if you and your caucus in the intervening weeks and months since last we talked and the governor unveiled this proposal, where you stand on some of these larger ideas about changing our criminal justice system, at least in the way we decide to punish people long term for things that perhaps are nonviolent crimes, things that haven't caused people life or limb. Do you have thoughts on that?
I do, and I don't know where we will go at the end of the day with this, but I have to tell you, I have serious concerns about what we're calling decriminalization of certain drug crimes, and here's why. First of all, what we did a few years ago is we decriminalized, which means we made an infraction, which was formerly a misdemeanor, of possession of marijuana under a half an ounce. I didn't agree with that. Some people agreed, some people didn't. It passed at the end, and it has been the law of the land for the past few years. The way our law reads right now is if you possess a half an ounce of marijuana or more, up to 4 ounces, there's a certain crime you could be charged with and a certain penalty you can get. If you possess 4 ounces or more but less than, I believe, 1 kilo, there's another crime you could be charged with. Now, once you get over 1 kilo of whatever drug it is, it's a whole different ballgame. But the argument about the amount you're possessing is there an intent to sell? Now, we all know that just possessing a certain amount of a drug, a small amount, implies that it's for your personal use versus a large amount implies that you're intending to sell. Those are tools that our prosecutors and our judges and our court system have. The whole point of decriminalization of small amounts of marijuana, where the intention was to free up our corrections and our jail system because those people shouldn't go to jail. And you want to know what? I agree with you. Here's the problem. When we talk about the Second Chances Society, it should be called your Eighth or Ninth Chance Society, because any judge, any prosecutor, any lawyer, defense lawyer of any type will tell you that if you get caught with a small amounts of drugs, you can avail yourself of up to 8 or 9 different programs. So people aren't going to jail for those amounts of possession. And doing this is taking away all opportunity and availability for prosecutors and judges to do their job.
Themis Claridis is Republican House Minority Leader. Thanks again for coming in and talking with us about some of these issues. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And thanks also to Abby Anderson, Executive Director of the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. Thank you so much, Abby.
Thanks, John.
Our program produced by Lydia Brown. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.